Congress is coming back to Washington tonight after the midterm elections, but it's not the new Congress coming in. It is the same Congress that was here before the election, the same Congress that left your agency's spending bills undone. David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call and host of the Hawkins Here blog at rollcall.com, following the work of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees as they are getting ready to fund agencies for the rest of fiscal 15. And we've been talking about this, it seems like, since, you know, the Garfield administration, David, that this shouldn't be a tough pull. They know the top line numbers. They know essentially the top line numbers for all the bills. It's the lines underneath that they should be working on and that seem to be foiling the process so far. Is that an unfair read on my part?
No, that's the right read, and it's even more important than all that. I guess one other way of continuing that sort of description is it's the lines that don't have any numbers in them at all that are the big hang-ups, which I mean it's the lines that say, notwithstanding any other provision of law, no money may be spent to do XXX, carry out Obamacare, enforce EPA regulations of coal-fired power plants, you name it. So it's those policy writers that are also the biggies. The word that we're getting, I think, today, and it is a fluid story, I think the sense that we're getting today, and we'll know more, as you say, when members come back in the next day or tonight and tomorrow, for legislating that really kicks off again on Wednesday, the sense we're getting now is more and more Republicans are willing to let the current year's appropriations debate come to an end in the lame duck. Obviously, the new fiscal year began October 1st. They're willing to let the current year come to an end with an omnibus that would be written between now and December 11th. But these confrontational conservative Republicans and many of the newcomers know full well that that appropriations is their best vehicle for constraining or conscribing the behavior of the Obama administration for the next 2 years, and so expect maybe regular order because the Republicans will be controlling both the House and the Senate, but many more of those policy writers like the ones I described anymore, which is to tell the president he can't spend money on things he wants to spend money on.
It's an interesting development because I think all of the political pundits were saying before the election, well, if they win, they might want to just pass a CR until they can get to January, and then the Republicans can hash it all out amongst themselves. How do they win politically, I guess, is the question, by going down the road that you just described and essentially giving the Democratic majority in the Senate, at least for the next, 4 days or however long the lame duck session runs. I'm being silly, but they're not here that long. Why do they give them a voice? Why don't they just hold off until January and control the process for the whole rest of the year?
Some of that would be, the answer would be poisoning the well from the very start. I think Mitch McConnell, he was the one who stood up the morning after the election, or 2 days after the election last week, and said for the president to kind of stretch the boundaries of good taste, in his view, on executive by using executive authority to ease deportations would be waving the bloody sheet in front of the bull. Remember when McConnell said that?
Yes.
About the president. So in return, McConnell may well think it would be waving a similar red sheet in front of the Democrats to say we're going to take away your right to finish out your 2 years of elected control by finishing the budget.
That's an almost mind-blowing turn of events, David, that somebody would actually say, Uncle, I'm going to stop doing to you what I hate you doing to me. I don't mean that in a partisan way, and I don't mean it in a cynical way. We haven't seen that on the Hill.
That's true.
In the last, half decade or decade, or maybe we can take it back maybe to 1994, and we haven't seen that. And that's been the source, it seems to me, and a lot of other observers, of the kind of bickering and fighting and lack of accomplishment that we've seen in the last 20 years.
All that's true. I would say that Senator McConnell is old school. By training, by sort of legislative training and by practice, you know, he's been around for 30 years, and for 25 of those years, the premium was put on getting the best deal you could in the time you had. And I think that's the way he wants to at least start out in his new year as majority leader. And for him to do that, with any, for him to have a chance of doing that, he needs to show the confrontational conservatives who's boss, and he needs to set a tone for how he's going to be next year. And I think that this is his first way of showing that.
It's an interesting dynamic because he's got 52 votes in the bank.
Right.
He's got potentially 53 if Cassidy wins in Louisiana. And I think the race in Alaska, Sullivan, the Republican, is still ahead of Begich, but it's not been certified is the last that I saw this
morning.
That's
right. They don't exactly, because Alaska is so huge and rural and disparate, and it's almost the case where some ballots are being brought in by sled dog. I don't think that's quite literally the case, but it's almost that way, that the two campaigns say they're not even sure how many ballots are out there yet to be counted. So neither Sullivan is afraid to sort of declare victory, nor is Begich prepared to concede defeat.
So, but if that turns out the way that it appears to now, that's 54.
Right.
Then we see there will be a decent percentage of the time, maybe not a majority of the time, that Manchin of West Virginia votes with the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
There will be some of the time that they can expect Senator King from Maine to vote with the Republicans. Now we're up to 56. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know how this counting goes. That means he's only got to wrangle four votes here and there to do just about anything he wants on the Senate side.
That's right. And he's not going to get those. Mitch McConnell is not going to. He's going to get those votes on some things. I would say Mark Warner from Virginia, having been
scared
almost out of, you know, almost within a couple of thousand votes of losing his job. He will want, I'm predicting, will want to redouble his efforts at being, you know, the purple senator that he ran to be. So he'll be with McConnell on some things. There are only a handful of those. You know, the number of so-called purple Democratic senators got smaller with this election.
Yep.
And may get smaller still if Mary Landrieu loses. So the possibility exists that Mitch McConnell will have a hard time getting past the 52 to 54, and all the while will have to be fighting a rear guard action to make sure that, you know, 10, 12, 15 of his own people don't sort of poison him from the right. In other words, Mitch McConnell is now facing something similar to what John Boehner has had to deal with for the past 4 years.
The possibility exists, though, that we can see what we saw in 2006 and we can see what we saw in 1994, which was, I mean, remember, Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole became the leaders of their chambers in 1994, said similar things to what McConnell and Boehner have said this week about Bill Clinton, and we had a government shutdown a year and a half later.
You're right, we did, and then as soon as that was over, you know, it was sort of the old adage, it's always darkest before the dawn. What some people, you know, don't remember, and which I'd sort of forgotten, too, until I was trying to remind myself what happened after that was, after they got the government shut down, 1996 was one of the most productive years in the history of divided government. I mean, they got welfare reform, they got a clean water bill, they got an energy bill. It was 1996 was a rockin' productive time. So
interesting.
So there are precedents to support almost any theory.
Okay, so we don't have then necessarily a historic precedent to draw from, and we will continue to watch the events play themselves out over the next couple of weeks and look for your guidance on that. Do we take away after a week or so now to look at what happened? Any significant changes that we haven't discussed yet about potential changes in committee chairs and so on among people who oversee the federal government? Any surprises coming down the pike that we should pay attention to?
I think there still may be some surprises ahead on how the so-called cardinals, the chairmanships of the appropriations subcommittees. There's some talk that a very, very junior member, Andy Harris, the Republican from Maryland, they may be positioning him to take over the Labor, Health, and Education subcommittee because it's considered the subcommittee that nobody really wants on the Republican side. That's one sort of rumor that we're trying to chase down.
And he's a doctor, so that would be a logical fit.
He's a physician, but he's also in that way he'd be a logical fit. But he is also the person on the committee who is most tuned in to the Tea Party freshman class of 2 and 4 years ago. So that would be interesting. At the other, on the other sort of flip side of that, the word we're trying to chase down this afternoon is that Jeff Sessions, the extremely conservative Republican from Alabama, actually the only senator who won re-election last week without any major party opposition, might get boxed out of his plans to chair the Senate Budget Committee. That Mike Enzi, who is more of a sort of old-school deal-cutting centrist, as far as what being a centrist in today's Republican Party goes, that he may assert his seniority with the backing of Mitch McConnell to bump Jeff Sessions out of the way at Senate budget.